when you, like Esther, have the courage to step forward and do something that furthers justice and righteousness, truth, and anymore in our culture, logical reasoning, and God gives you a victory that you never thought you would see coming, what do you do? What do you do? What do you, should you do? And that's what you find as you close out this little book from chapter 9, verse 17 through 10, verse 3. It really answers the question of what you should do when God gives you a victory. Because I'm sure Mordecai and Esther didn't think that they were going to get the victory like the Lord gave them, but he did. So when God shocks you, what should you do? You should do four things, and you find these embedded in the text. The first thing that you should do is responding to God's righteous, what I've called throughout the book, a righteous reversal that just leaves you stunned. First thing you should do is realize that victories over evil should be enjoyed. You should enjoy it. Now, you might be a half glass or half, you know, the glass is half empty kind of person. Even though the greatest things happen, you're always like the naysayer. Well, that was, you know, but there's always another day for bad things to happen. If that's you, is that you? Yeah. Look at verse 17, where he talks about what you should do. He says, "There was this was done on the 13th day of the month of Adar, which was the last month in the Jewish religious calendar. And on the 14th day, they rested from combat. And they made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. But the Jews who were in Susa, which is the capital of the fortress, on the 13th and the 14th of the same month, Adar, they rested on the 15th day, and they made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. Therefore, the Jews in the rural areas who live in the rural towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar, last day of the Jewish calendar, remember? A day, a holiday for rejoicing and feasting and sending portions of food to one another." So what you find in this little tiny, what's called a pericope, little paragraph analysis that has the same motif, you have that after 2 days of open combat all over the 2.1 million square mile kingdom of the superpower Persia, as the Jews defended themselves from those who tried to wipe them out after Haman died, after all of that occurred, when they got victory, they were happy. So what'd they do? What does it say they did? What'd they do? They partied. Yeah, they rejoiced and they feasted. I mean, they were excited. They were relieved that God had given them the victory, because genocide was imminent, and it had been for almost an entire year. Remember Psychops? They were playing for about a year to wipe them out on the 13th of Adar. And so at the beginning of the year, Haman came up with this plan, as we'll see through divination, and then God's going to turn this whole thing around. So when God gives you a huge turnaround, the first thing you should realize is you should be excited about it. So think about Israel today. So the last holdout for Hamas is in Rafah, right? Subterranean tunnels, very dangerous to try to root out the last bastions of terrorists. Suppose they were to go in there this week and defeat the final terrorists and actually free the 130 hostages, and they found them alive. Would that not be a day of great rejoicing? It would be. And you can see how easily, I mean, that's just freeing 130 hostages. These Jews, when they fought the ancient Persians back then, they freed an entire nation from genocide that was slated. And so, total excitement. So when God gives you a victory, what should you do? Be excited. Be excited about it. So you should switch from being the glasses half empty to the glasses half full and go, oh yeah, it's so much better here over on this side. Do you know what the sword of Damocles is? It's a yes or a no. Yes. Yes. How many don't know what the sword of Damocles is? Oh, really? Serious? Okay. So if you need to read about the ancient story of the sword of Damocles, but it's about a servant that goes to a king and tells the king, basically, your job's not that hard. I could do it all day long. And the king's like, oh, so you want my job? And so the king says, okay, I'll let you, we'll trade. I'll let you be the king for the day and I'll be the servant, gladly. And so the king dons the servant clothes, puts them on, and the servant becomes the king, sits down in the chair. But before he sits down in the throne, the king says, oh, there's one more thing we need to do. We need to hang a massive razor-sharp sword over your head on a really thin, like, string. And the servant's like, well, like, what's that for? And the king's like, that's what it's like to be the king. You're always doing things to impact people and try to help people and grow the kingdom, but hanging over your head is this giant sword that can drop at any minute and ruin your day. Glass is half empty kind of thing, sort of Damocles. Don't you ever feel like that when something really amazing happens in your life and you're like, that was really awesome, I know it's going to go away. It's, you know, it's going to be worse the rest. You ever feel like that? Be honest. I get like that. So that's why I look at the sword of Damocles and like, yeah, I can understand that. When you're the leader, wow, it looks like it'd be fun to be a leader. Comes with a huge responsibility and the propensity for things to happen that aren't pleasant. Well, you still should enjoy your life, right? So when God gives you a righteous reversal, because he's going to give you one when you're courageous, and he gives you a righteous reversal where you stand your ground, push back evil, don't call me and tell me you're depressed, okay? Just tell me, man, we're having a party over here at my house. We are so excited with what God did, okay? Number two, second thing you should do, victories over evil should be embedded. So they should be enjoyed, and they should be embedded. Translated, you don't want to forget this one. Notice what it says in verse 20. Then Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, that's Xerxes, both near and far, obliging them to celebrate the 14th month of Adar and the 15th of the same month, and to do it annually. Because on those days, the Jews rid themselves of their enemies who were going to wipe out the entire Jewish country, nation among the Persians. And it was a month which was turned for them from sorrow to gladness, from mourning into a holiday. So righteous reversal. That they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and sending portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written unto them. So what you read there is when they were freed from genocide and they were all excited, it just happened just spontaneously, like organically, just all throughout the empire. People, as they had pockets of resistance, were wiped out, and the Jews were freed from those who tried to wipe them out. They just started rejoicing and feasting. And so then Mordecai comes along as the second in command and says, we need to embed this into the culture. We need to make sure that we Jews never forget this. And so that is what he did. He wants them to remember that God providentially orchestrated their deliverance. Didn't happen by chance. Because God put it all in motion. But I think if you look at Mordecai as a man who's now in political life, he understands the human condition is to forget things. Don't you forget things? Husbands? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Happens to me all. I've been married 43 years. My wife's like, why can you remember all these facts about Hebrew verbs and Greek verbs and all these words and all this, these dates of this battle, that battle, and you can't find your car keys? I finally put an Apple tracker on my car keys. I also put them on other things that I tend to lose. Yeah, don't you? And I use them, that, you know, you hit the little button and it pings, bing. It's like, yes. Because, you know, the brain cells, and they die. And, you know, and okay, so I don't remember where my car keys are. So we forget things, don't you? Right? And so you think about the propensity to forget something great. It's just built into the human condition. I was thinking this week just about, you know, my parents, my grandparents, my family in South Carolina. I mean, many of them were World War II vets. And, you know, one of my cousins drove a tank for Patton. And, I mean, you think about all of your family, like what they did. They were most excited about VE Day, right? Remember VE Day? Yeah, I would say that if you go to the typical 17, 18-year-old and go, man, VE Day is coming up. Yeah, March 7th. We're ready to celebrate. They're going to be looking at you going, huh? And if you were to ask him, what does VE Day stand for as an acronym, you're going to get the deer in headlights look. Because they're like, VE Day, it's like video extravaganza day? You know, no. So what happened on May 7th, 1945? Do you know? What did Germans do? They surrendered. They surrendered. In France, they surrendered. They came in and they surrendered. And so on the next day, the 8th of May, that's when Winston Churchill came out on a balcony speaking to thousands and thousands of people in England. And that's where he came out and says, my dear friends, this is your hour. Yeah, you remember? I'm not him, but you know. You've heard the speech. Yeah, this is your hour, you know. And so he comes out and just encourages the people because evil had been overcome with good. Harry Truman, remember him? Three people do. Yeah, how old are you? Yeah, remember him? Yeah, so he came out, he gave a speech. But what happened in the streets of America? That happened. And you know it's America because, could we go back a slide? That one, yeah. You know it's America because, see the Pepsi-Cola sign? People are in the streets waving flags, kissing each other, strangers hugging. I mean, unbelievable. Here's another picture. These are Jewish people in England. What are they doing? Feasting. This is like the Feast of Purim. They've got it going on here. Everybody was excited. Just type in VE Day and you see all the pictures that pop up. You know, American GIs, MPs alongside the road cheering. Everybody's excited. But how many people today actually remember that day or the emotion of that day? My parents, you know, they do. And my grandparents did. Etc. And my great grandparents, for sure, that I knew some of them growing up. So Mordecai knows the human condition is to forget. So we are prone to the same thing. So when God gives you a great victory, you know it's like, man, this is exciting for today. You're going to probably forget that in like 6 or 7 months. And so he says you need to embed this into your thinking so that other people can know about this. Verses 24 to 26. We're going to skip ahead. Says the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who allied themselves with them so that they should not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to the regulation and according to their appointed time annually. So the days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city, and these days of Purim, that's what they called it, not to fail from among the Jews or their memory fade from their descendants. Why were there 2 celebration days? I forgot to tell you about that. The people in the outlying areas overcame the genocidal enemies quicker than they did in the capital. Susa was more fortified. That took longer. So they established their day first before they established their day. So they ended up with 2 days. 2 days of celebrations of victory. So they're going to add this feast to the structure of what God gave them in the Mosaic Covenant. So God had given them through Moses' pen many different feasts to observe. They're going to add this one to it. So they had the Feast of Passover, which was on Nisan the 14th, which is March and April. There was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Pentecost, or the Feast of First Fruits. There was Rosh Hashanah, or the Feast of Trumpets. There was the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Kippur is the Hebrew word for covering. You're either covered or you're uncovered before God. The only thing that covers sin is the blood of a sacrifice. The only thing that covers your sin today is the blood of Christ applied to you by faith, and you're saved. And so they had the Day of Atonement. They had tabernacles or Feast of Booths. They're going to add Feast of Purim to that because they look at this and they say, in the Exodus, God delivered his people from slavery and bondage from hundreds of years, and he did it in a spectacular, miraculous fashion. But it was also highly ironic, wasn't it? I mean, if you go back and you study the story of Moses, or if you've seen the movie, yeah, Cecil B. DeMille. Yeah, you know, where they, you know, put little Moses in the water in a little basket, and he floats downstream in the Nile, and all of a sudden, I think, was it Nefertari? Pharaoh's daughter sees the little basket, pulls it out. Oh, it's a Jewish boy, and it's Moses. And Moses' name, Moshe, in Hebrew, means to be drawn out of the water. Boy, they named him correctly. And, you know, he grows up to be, you know, a prince, and read Josephus. He becomes a general in the Egyptian army, etc. But his life kind of went south after he killed the Egyptian, and they ran him out of town. And then when he's in his 80s, I mean, it's been, you know, like 40 years later, he's tending sheep, and his life's dramatically changed when he sees a burning bush. And then God tells him in his 80s, I need you to go back and free Israel. He's like, are you kidding? He's like, no, it's you. You know the story. Here I am, Lord, send Aaron. You know, because I stutter, and Aaron doesn't stutter. He's more articulate. Send him, not me. And you know the story. They both got sent, right? Anyway, back to my sermon. So they're going to add this to the feast structure that came out in the Mosaic Law because God had moved providentially to free his people from genocide, saved them, and they knew that. And so they call it Purim, P-U-R-I-M. So Pur, in the language of the Persians, meant dice. And so it referred to rolling dice. So what did Haman do? If you remember back in chapter 3, verses 7 and 13, this is where Haman would roll the dice to determine what day did the gods want the Jews to be eliminated in ancient Persia, on modern day Iran. Kind of ironic, isn't it? What would they, and so the gods, which would be demons, told him, well, it's going to be on the 13th of Adar. And so when the Jews are delivered, from their enemies, from all the things we've studied, they take that name, Pur, for dice, and they add an I-M ending on it. And if you take an I-M and you add it to a Hebrew word, you make it plural. So case in point, cherub denotes what? A cherub is a what? It's an angel. It's an angel. Cherubim is what? Angels, plural. Yeah, yeah. And so you add that I-M ending and you pluralize the word. So they don't call it Pur, they call it Purim. Because more dice were used. And it's totally ironic, isn't it? Haman's rolling dice to hear what the gods, demons, have to say about what's a great day to wipe out all the Jews. God's going to come along and go, oh, no, I've taken a young Jewish lady. I've made her the queen of the nation. No one knows it, but they're about to find out. And I've taken her cousin, Mordecai, and I'm going to elevate both of them to stop this genocide. And so the Persians didn't know what hit them. And so God delivered them. And so they're going to call the feast by the very name that their enemy had used to judge them. This is ironic. Purim. So God had saved them. But what Haman didn't know is if you roll dice, God knows what's coming up. Do not pray at a casino. Don't go to a casino. That's a whole nother sermon. Proverbs 16:33 says, the lot or dice are cast into the lap, but it's every decision is by total chance. I'm glad you can read. Yes, it came from the Lord. Yeah. So you roll the dice, and you're thinking, oh, man, I'm playing my wife this game, and I need a double. I need sixes right now. Okay, and you know, and God knows now you're going to get a four and a two. You know, that type of thing. So the Persians don't know the living God can control the roll of the dice for this evil man, Haman, to make it to where he thinks he's gonna eliminate the Jews on the 13th of Adar. No, it's gonna flip around. The gallows you build will become your gallows. I'm gonna turn things around. This is how great God is. So there is no chance in the cosmos. You understand this? If there is a living God who's providential, who is omniscient and knows all things, he doesn't have to learn what the dice roll is going to be. He knows ipso facto what it is. I was in a casino in Lake Tahoe years ago, in my early 30s. I was in town for a sabbatical by Lake Tahoe. Friends have a condo there. I've gone there for many years for sabbaticals, very restful. And I decided to go in and get some food. Casino food's a little cheaper. So I went there. I think I was in Harvey's in Lake Tahoe. And no, I was in Caesars. Yeah, I was in Caesars. And I'm sitting there, and my uncle, Tony, Antonio Sanchez from Barcelona, is with me. And so as we're going through the casino to get to the restaurant, we pass by a craps table. You know what those are? Yeah. Yeah, they roll the dice and all the numbers, and I don't know anything about it. So I asked my uncle, like, explain what's going on here on this table to me. So we stopped, and we're looking at all the numbers and probability of this and that. While we're standing there, an old guy walks in, a bum. I mean, an old beat up guy off the street, whiskers. I mean, look like he needed a shave, needed a bath, clothes are all jacked up. He walks in with a paper sack. And he walks over to the pit boss and he hands it to the pit boss and he reaches in there and he pulls out $600. I'm like, it's gotta be his last $600. And then he tells the pit boss, I want this put on snake eyes to be the next roll. 30 to one. Is that a good bet? Next roll? And so the pit boss is like, okay. So he put all the chips on 30 to one on snake eyes. And I'm standing there, guess what? Next roll was snake eyes. Do the math. How much money did that guy walk away with? There's mathematicians here. 31, $600. You were English majors? It was a lot of money. I'm like, oh my. Okay, so did that outfox God? No. No. Just don't ever try that when you go in there, right? I'm just saying that's how powerful God is. God knows. And so God controlled the dice Haman was using to deliver his people. So verse 29 tells you that Esther enters the story. It says, Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote the full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And he sent letters to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, namely words of peace and truth. Basically, read those verses and what happened. Esther comes along and says, oh, my cousin Mordecai has made this a national holiday. I'm the queen. I'm going to put my seal of approval on it. I agree with him. We should never forget what God did. They embedded it. Think about your life. When God does something great in your life, when you were brave and bold for him, and God gives you a victory, Who do you tell? Who remembers it with you? Because this is the kind of thing that you want to tell your children. You are not going to believe what happened, you know, back in 2015 or whatever. You want to tell them why, so they can fear God, so they can have great hope in God's ability, so they can understand that God works in ironic, hopeless situations to do great ironic reversals, so that when they're put in a position to be brave, they'll be brave because they know God's with them. So embed it in your family. Tell them. Next, victories over evil should be expounded. It says, for Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them, and he cast the poor, which means dice, that is the lot, to disturb them and to destroy them. But when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that this wicked scheme which had been devised against the Jews should return upon its own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the poor. And because of the instructions of this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what they had happened, it happened to them. I mean, lex talionis, like eye for eye, tooth for tooth, what goes around comes around. You reap what you sow. And so what they did in this particular section of the scripture is they recounted the history of what happened. They just recounted it. Yeah, there was Haman rose to the second in command. He wanted to wipe out all the Jews because he couldn't stand Mordecai. He created gallows for Mordecai, but he ended up being hung on the gallows. But he did that after he was paraded around. Or he had to parade Mordecai around town on the king's horse with the king's crown. And yeah, it's unbelievable. So they go and they recount the story. So what does this tell you? That when you embed this into your family to remember the great thing that God did, so you can praise God because of it and teach your children and your grandchildren, you should also expound exactly what happened. I mean, give them the details. Give them the details. I was sitting at a Promise Keepers one time explaining to them during a break. It was in Atlanta at the Georgia Dome, and I was explaining to a pastor I was with this amazing thing that God had just done in my life. And we're on break. Everybody, all the pastors are moving around. A bunch of pastors in front of me, they're talking among themselves, but one of them is listening to me tell this story about what God had done. And I'm telling this other pastor. And after I got done telling the story, that pastor turned around. He goes, I am blessed. He goes, that's amazing. He said, I feel totally blessed by what you just told that guy. I'm like, you listen to my conversation? You know, but I'm expounding to my friend the greatness of God, so God gets the praise. Amen. And that's what you're doing. And then who knows who else is around you listening to this? They get blessed. So bless somebody. You sound so positive today. I'm trying to get you pumped up. So I know it's early, it's tough, but that's what they did. Now, if you read how the Jews observe Purim today, they read the Esther story during this time of festival twice, all the way through. Why? So that every generation really remembers exactly what happened. Because if you don't remember the past, what's gonna happen? Probably doomed to repeat it, as we are taught. Bravery. And remembering what happened. On December the 16th, 1944, Battle of the Bulge. 19,000 American soldiers died that day during that battle. 15,000 became prisoners of war. There was one young man, Sergeant Lester Tanner, was taken prisoner. He was a Christian. And listen to what he did when he realized the Germans were going to shoot Jews that were soldiers. When the Germans, he said, came at us in force, I threw away my dog tags, which had my religion on it. He said the Germans announced that the Jews had to form up in front of the barracks the next morning, and those who did not would be shot. So the Christian American GI threw his dog tags away. So the next morning, this is what we learn in a series on PBS called GI Jews, Jewish Americans in World War II, says this. Narrator says, Master Sergeant Roddy Edmonds, a Protestant from Knoxville, Tennessee, was known for his strong leadership and moral conviction. He was the commanding officer in charge of 1,275 American prisoners. Master Sergeant Roddy Edmonds said, we will all be there in the morning in formation, and I will be at the head. The next morning, he says, we were lined up. German Major Sigmund marched over and said, where are all the Jews? And the sergeant says, this morning, we are all Jews. And the German officer said, that's impossible. You 1,275 of you can't all be Jews. He said, today we are. And so the officer threatened to shoot this young man dead for not letting the Jews step forward. There were 200 Jews in their ranks. And the officer told him, he said, we're going to win this war. And when we remember this, when we finish this war, we're going to remember that you shot me and they're going to prosecute you for a war crime. And you need to think about that. With that, the officer put his Luger in its holster and walked away. And they saved 200 Jewish soldiers that day. That's the kind of story you want to remember, right? As I'm sure every single man that was alive that day remembered what that sergeant did to deliver them. So you want to tell the story. Tell the story, embed it into your culture, and make sure you expound the details. Lastly, 10 verses 1 to 3, short chapter. We can do it. Victories over evil should be what? Encouraging. You should be encouraged. It says, now King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea and all the accomplishments of his authority and his strength and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king had advanced him. Are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings in Media Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, great among the Jews, and in favor with the multitude of his kinsmen, one who had sought the good of his people and who spoke for the welfare of the whole nation. What should you be encouraged about? Two things. Number one, this is called inclusio. I-N-C-L-U-S-I-O. Inclusio means you end how you began. A lot of speakers do it. You end how you began. It's powerful. It's like an ultimate climax. How did this story begin? With Xerxes having great power and authority, right? That's how the story began in chapter one. How is it ending? Beside all the bad things that happened to Xerxes in the middle of the book, he had two Jews assigned to him that were courageous. And you see the book ends the same way. He's now back to being powerful and in control, but God had placed two God-fearing Jews in his life that transformed his life. Which tells you, when God finishes your story, it's a story to be known, to repeated, so that God gets the glory. Because these two people, Mordecai and then Esther, didn't just impact the people for that one event. It says that he went on to take care of the welfare of his nation until his career ended. So when God gives you that victory, that righteous reversal, it's to be enjoyed at a point in time, but it's also to tell you, God's not done with you. There's another thing on another day that he's going to have you work with, and you need to care for people and impact people. You're never finished. Is the word retirement in the Bible? No. Yeah. So you got me for the next 30 years, I'm saying. I don't know. You know, oxygen tank on wheels, you know, walker, canes, whatever. No, God is never finished with you no matter where you are. But when he gives you a reversal, that's righteous in nature, be encouraged. So one question that I will pose to you before we finish, based on this book, can God count on you to step up to the plate and be courageous? Can he count on you? Because he'll bless you when you do it. Why don't we stand? God, thank you for the opportunity to study this great book about how you delivered your people, Israel, from Persian genocidal aims. You delivered them and you cared for them because you had a plan with them to bring the Messiah through them. Nothing was going to thwart that plan. And even today, you are going to return as the great King of Kings, and your people will be there to receive you according to Zechariah 12 and 13. And they will look upon whom the one they have pierced, and they will come to bow before you as King of Kings. So even what's going on today is not going to thwart your plan. And we thank you for how great you are. Help us in the interim to be courageous, as an Esther was or a Mordecai, and bless the work of our hands. In Christ's name, amen.